The views and opinions of shows on KCNR are those of the hosts, guests, and callers only, and do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or advertisers of KCNR Radio.
Good morning, everybody.
Hello. Welcome
to We the People Radio. A little bit late this morning. My ride didn't show up. I have a private driving service that brings me into the station. You know, when you're a famous radio announcer, you get special privileges.
Hey, because we were sleeping in our sleep number bed.
Yeah.
We got a new sleep number bed yesterday.
Yeah, blame it on the bed. There we go.
Nothing like spending the whole night, you know, more or less, feet up, feet down. Yeah. That was fun, actually.
My little dog fell down in the crack. Oh, my gosh.
I know. Eddie's not crazy about the sleep number crack there. Not good.
That's not the sleep number crack.
We do a little commercial for the sleep number crack.
No, we don't do that.
But actually, they're not advertisers on this show, but they are advertisers on the station.
They are huge advertisers on this station. Yes, we'll. I'm going to save that and use it for a commercial on Free Fire Radio this week.
We lost our little dog in the crack of our sleep number bed. There's got to be some kind of a country western song for that, isn't there?
Oh, I'm sure there is.
Yeah.
I'm sure there is. But, anyway. You know, if you'd like to join this conversation, you can call us at 605-4567, or we're streaming and chatting live at We the People Radio.
Oh, sure. Easy for you to say.
US. Yeah.
WePeopleRadio.us. That's where Robert hangs out and makes us these great pages all the time. So let's see. Our guest this morning is Michael Walsh. And Bill would read his bio, but he can't because his computer was dead when he got here.
My driving service forgot my cable again.
Oh, darn it. Huh. He had all that extra time.
Gosh.
So anyway, he's going to call us. He's calling us here in a little bit. He was going to church at 7 o'clock this morning.
He wrote a great book, didn't he?
Yes, he did, under a different name, which is kind of fun. And we'll have him get into the whole why he uses two names thing. I mean, how much fun if you're a writer, you can write under one name and be a conservative. You can write under the other name and be a liberal. It's like that literally is the best of both worlds.
I'm very confused.
Are we using his real name today?
Yeah, because his real name is Michael Walsh. And every picture I've ever seen of him, he has a cigar. He has, like, have you seen the picture of him?
No.
Yeah. WeThePeopleRadio.us. You could just go right on there. It's right on the front page. There you go.
Oh my God, it's Cigar Dave.
I know. Isn't it funny?
Oh my goodness. He's going to love this
good
guy.
Big cigar. He's awesome. So, but interesting, he wrote this book called Rules for Radical Conservatives, Beating the Left at Its Own Game to Take Back America.
So I'm all for it.
I know. So initially you're like, okay. So then you get to his bio, right? And you're expecting, you know, eats raw meat, chops down trees, stuff like that. No. After graduating from Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York in 1971, he became a reporter for the Rochester Democrat and Chronicle, where he shared the New York State Publishers Association first prize for reporting with two colleagues on a series about heroin in Rochester. So he, you know, goes to school and to the School of Music and becomes a writer and becomes kind of infamous for writing this article on heroin, which I'm sure his mom was like, what? And
do you know so much about that?
Bizarre, huh? Well, you know, looking at what we know now about, you know, like we had the Philip Seymour Hoffman thing and stuff like that, so I guess there's a lot of that. So he becomes the paper's classical music critic. He was named this is where you go. Easy for me to say. Huh? He was named chief classical music critic of the San Francisco Examiner in 1977, where he won a bunch of awards. So now he's like back to music, right? And then he was a visiting fellow of the university professor of journalism and film and television at Boston University. He's currently vice president of the board of the Wendy Museum, devoted to East German and Soviet art. Artifacts and scholarship in Culver City. See, it's just like he's a
very diverse fellow.
I know. He has to be two guys because there's too much for just one guy. Since February of 2007, he's written for the National Review, both under his own name and using a fictional persona, which is borrowed from a screenwriter character in the movie The Player. So the persona evolved into a Hollywood liberal who has the habit of sharing way too much about the rules by which they live to a conservative audience. So Rules for Radical Conservatives is written from a liberal's perspective, like sharing insider information.
Wow.
From a conservative who's a music critic.
Yeah. I'm still very confused.
I know. Isn't that awesome? Yes. I started reading this and I was like, oh, I bet this is the best book ever. I haven't gotten a chance to read it yet. So we're running blind. So about the book, I guess we have a few seconds here. About the book, The Vast Right-Wing Conspiracy has found its General Patton, and his name is David... I don't know if he's Kane or Kahane, or he'll have to tell us. He's a pseudonym. He does a satiric column for the National Review Online, lampooning the left via his Hollywood radical persona. He's like Stephen Colbert's liberal doppelganger. Doppelganger. Sounds so spitty when you say it on the radio. It's not a good radio word. And actually, every time you say it, it makes you laugh anyway, so you're totally distracted. So, you know, it's kind of modeled after Alinsky's Rules for Radicals, but the flip side. The doppelganger side.
Please. This is going to be a good show, folks.
It's going to be like that.
Yeah.
It's just going to be like that. So, we've got got a little video on there. Okay, so now that I've mangled that, that's who we have on today. Then next week, we have, he's an economist, Lauren Spivak.
Oh, Lauren Spivak, of course.
Nice.
What can you tell me about Lauren Spivak?
You are such an idiot.
Oh, nice. You cannot say that on the radio. I know there's a rule against that.
My carpool partner.
Ay, ay, ay.
But my sleep number's 40.
People wonder why I don't drive.
Bill thinks his sleep number's 55. So, oh yeah, okay, so a little brief interlude here on the sleep number thing. Okay, so we got the bed that has two sides. Well, obviously all beds have two sides, but we got the one where you can change the thing on both sides, right? So last night I'm like making mine lower and lower and lower, and I'm like, why is my bed so darn hard?
I'm laying in a hole, by the way, but at this time. Mine just keeps getting softer and softer.
The guy programmed our deal sideways. So when you're
controlling his side and he's controlling yours.
Yeah, but it took us like an hour to figure that out, which was pretty sad because I kept thinking I just couldn't tell.
I was sleeping on a flat tire.
And Bill's like, I want it at 100. So we had loads of fun, which is kind of why we're probably late this morning. Oh, my God. So what was that?
Oh, nothing. Nothing.
Was Bill's phone.
Nothing to see. Keep moving.
Move along.
Yeah.
Okay. So, and actually, Lauren's going to be at the tea party. He's coming to the tea party, so that'll be fun. We are going to have a lot of fun people. We're going to have Sam Paredes, you know, for those people that are following what goes on. This Monday, we have James Horn at the tea party. Monday night, 6 o'clock, Bonneville. No, it's not Bonneville Baptist. It's called Destiny Fellowship. Used to be called Bonneville Baptist, though. And James Horn's there tomorrow night at 6 o'clock, and he's a guy who, oh my gosh, he has an amazing, hold on here and I'll just get to it. Oops, except you got to know his actual web address here. He is jameshorn.com. No, he's not. He's James Horn something else.
I'm staying out of this one.
Come on, his name's James Horn, darn it.
What's he going to talk about?
Oh, for Lord's sake. He's going to talk about Islam. He has an amazing...
Yeah, he actually lived there for 4 or 5 years, didn't he? Lived under Islam rule.
Here we go.
Sharia law and was a big part of that.
Yeah, he's a career diplomat, which is... You know, fairly interesting. Most of us have not done that before. He was born in an army hospital near Kansas City, Missouri, because he wanted to be near his mother. That's what Dick Wilkinson always says.
It's always a good idea when you're first born to be close to your mother.
Be near your mother. I guess we should tell Abel and Mrs. Congrats on...
Abel Mojica, the gentleman I work with, had a brand new baby at 2 o'clock this morning. 7 pounds, 11 ounce boy, AJ. Welcome to the universe.
We have a new voter.
Yeah, we have a new voter.
Was that you that called me at 2 o'clock this morning to tell me that?
No, I didn't do that.
Someone called me at exactly 2 o'clock.
There is no 2 o'clock in my morning.
The new kid's got a built-in phone.
Ha!
That's crazy.
And you know, he was born on his due date, so he'll always be on time.
Exactly.
Unlike my driving service.
Like, okay, this better be good if it's 2 o'clock in the morning. Hello, click.
Oh, no. Somebody drunk
child. Just a random wake-up call.
Bummer. I still have their phone number on my...
Oh, I have a plan for
you
that.
Do?
Yeah. iPhone, yes.
But. Oh, yeah, we can take care of that caller.
Wow, somebody drunk dialed you right at 2 o'clock.
You can set your watch by the...
I think we need to get them on the air this morning.
Like 1 now?
Yeah, let's get them on the
air. Let's call them early. Yeah, you should call them around 6. But then you'd have to actually wake up at 6, which would suck. All right, back to James Horn. He is at the Tea Party Monday night, the 10th, February 10th, here in Reading. He joined the State Department and worked abroad for more than a quarter century, mostly in third world countries. 10 of those years in the Middle East, where he came to know and clearly understand the true Islam far better than most. It kind of goes on and on and on, all sorts of different stuff. He held the highest levels of top secret security clearances with, and I don't even know what this means, but with code word access to sensitive compartmentalized intelligence.
Oh, I have that.
Yeah. He's gotten all sorts of different awards. A civilian award for valor in Cambodia for rescuing wounded civilians from a bombed and burning building while under hostile fire.
Wow.
I know. He's like one of those guys from the movies.
Yeah. He's 21. Is that 21?
I don't know. Is that what they did in that show?
CSI, whatever. Yeah, I don't know. I'm making it up.
New York, Los Angeles, some city. Yeah, put a city behind it. It's probably a show. Since retiring and moving to California, Jim's been active in educating Americans about the true nature of Islam, working in private sector security, counterterrorism, and he's consulted with law enforcement. Makes sense.
There you go.
Maybe you could help him with that guy who's making whatever he was making with all the bomb stuff
the bombs
or whatever.
Out there. Yeah.
What's going on with that? Do you know, Bob? Going to be our man on the street interview?
I don't know if I guess I'm not talking out of school, but I've heard quite a bit about it because one of this man's neighbors is one of our own. Bad Bob Belongi.
Oh, yeah.
Is Belongi's neighbor.
Oh, ooh. Boy.
He was living next to a bomb factory and he didn't even know it?
Was he
wasn't really making bombs. I shouldn't say that. It was explosives. Let's keep it to explosives.
The authorities don't know what he was making. And Bob has only been able to get back into his house with the help of the authorities at this point. They still have a
general... Because he's too close to all the explosiveness?
Evacuation of that block.
Lovely.
And our guest is calling in, I think.
Nice.
Oh, wonderful.
Well, say hi.
Wonder if we should take a break real quick before...
Well, let Bob say hi.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
He only has so many hands.
Okay.
Just because you don't have anything to do. Because
he's got all the buttons over there.
Your computer isn't working.
I'm buttonless this morning.
We're going to send Bill home to get a cord. Home and get the cord.
Get the cord.
Oh, what a drag.
Oh, man.
So, yeah, we're excited, though. Michael Walsh is going to give us a ton of information this morning. We have... Mm-hmm. We have lots on him, but...
Well, we need all the help we can get. Apparently in California, we've forgotten how to be a Republican conservative, and we're slightly outnumbered
in that field.
That is Mr. Walsh standing by.
Mr. Walsh standing by? How the heck are you?
Oh, well, I don't have him.
Oh.
You actually want to speak to him?
Oh.
Oh.
All right, here he is.
That's
okay, so I'll do
game.
It again. Mr. Walsh standing by. How the heck are you?
Hi, how are you?
So... We just were reading some of your stuff, and so who would you like to be today? You can tell us all about that?
No, look, the name is gone. We can just talk about me.
Nice. Just talk about me.
Yeah, it's about you this morning.
It is, too. You've done enough stuff. You could fill several programs.
Oh, God. How are you guys?
Hey, we're super. We had a little we had a little scurry this morning,
but we're
done with that part now.
The other side.
Now we're moving on to good topics.
Okay, good. I found a quiet place so we can talk for a little bit. That's good.
Super. All right. So, what would you? It's totally up to you. What would you like to tell us?
I don't know. It's just too early in the morning for me to think. So I'll answer questions. How about that?
Talk to us about your name that you write. Okay, the rules for radical conservatives, it threw me because I knew you wrote it, but when I looked it up, it had a different author. So then I started digging into why it had a different author. But I'd rather hear that from you.
Okay, sure. We can do that.
Yeah, so
Far away.
So who are we talking to?
No, no, seriously, why did you start doing that? Because I think it's a cool idea.
Oh, well, the name David Kahane started as a joke a few years back. If you've ever seen the movie The Player, directed by Robert Altman, there's a screenwriter character in that named David Kahane. And he gets murdered by the studio executive. And since I'm a screenwriter, I thought that would be a perfect name to take to write the character of a mock lefty screenwriter in Hollywood who comments on political issues. So I started it about 5 years ago, and it stayed a kind of inside joke until the book came out in 2010, I guess it was. And then I had to come out and admit that I did it. But it was fun while it lasted.
That's pretty cool. So what does David Kahane have for conservatives in a pivotal year in 2014?
Well, I should say not much because I've retired the character. But when he was writing, the idea was to take the leftist point of view on conservative issues and mock it. But in so doing, mock the left itself, so that the book is kind of a double parody of both of the left's view of conservatives and our view of the left, which I would say is much closer to the truth than their view of us is. And since the book came out, I've stopped writing it as Kahane, but I think the book is worth talking about because it gets at the basic principles of how we should be combating them. I've been dealing with the left since 1967, so that's quite a long time.
Well, you've had plenty of material to work with. I mean, if you stick around California very long.
Yeah, well, I'm in and out of California. I live in rural New England, and I live in very, very rural Ireland, so I'm relatively immune from the day-to-day shenanigans of the left, but I have spent a great deal of time here. I grew up here, so I'm used to the left here as well, and God knows it certainly caused our great state plenty of trouble. If you drive up and down the Central Valley, for example, you can see how the effects of the leftist program influenced the lives of ordinary people in a very, very baleful and deleterious way, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's going to continue until people wise up a little bit. Pain hasn't apparently gotten great enough yet.
You know, that's the question. Well, I once wrote years ago on another blog that what happens in American society is that leftists worm into a perfectly good functioning place and they gradually wreck it in the guise of compassion. And then eventually the good people who are left call the police and throw them out.
Well, you know, I've always been a believer in people won't react or get involved in these types of things until it directly affects them. And I think we're there now, and I still don't see a lot of people rising up and saying, hey, enough's enough. I mean, what's it going to take?
I think it's changed. Well, I think it's changed because they've done one thing. I was referring specifically then to New York City after the first Dinkins administration, which I lived through in Manhattan. And after 4 years of Dinkins, even the extremely liberal New York City electorate voted Rudy Giuliani in. And interestingly, it changed almost overnight in terms of the perception of crime, which was very bad at the time, and the general quality of life. What's different, I think, here in California is that the California that I grew up in the 1950s has effectively been replaced by the Third World, by massive immigration, both legal and illegal, from Mexico and from other parts of the planet. And this is not a discussion about immigration or Mexico or anything else, but what it is a discussion is the replacement of the old electorate with the new electorate. So that is to say, the old electorate who grew up under the previous status quo is basically dying out, and the new electorate doesn't have the memories of a functioning California that we do. I mean, I remember when the roads were great and the schools were great and we had surplus in Sacramento and all sorts of things. Well, that's gone, but the people who live here now don't have that memory. And they accept the misery as normal, because after all, especially if you're an immigrant from the Third World, California misery is infinitely superior to wherever you came from. And so they're going to accept it. And I don't think you're going to see the revolution here that you saw in New York City back in the 1980s.
Well, I think a lot of what we're seeing now is not necessarily third world. I think it's from a different universe. I mean, these people are implementing things that are so out there, you know, sanctuary cities. I mean, it just goes on and on. And it is
effective. Yeah, but who invented sanctuary cities? The left did, of course.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, all their program, if you boil the left down to what it really its essence is, strip away the compassion and tolerance and all this other baloney that they constantly fog the air with, they're nihilists who are bent on the destruction of the pre-existing order. They're almost, it's hard to find a parallel in nature, because even sharks do good by eliminating carrion from the ocean. These people just want to wreck things. And why is the interesting question. But it's what they do. It is the practical result of what they do. I'm actually writing a book about this right now.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
And, okay, hold on for 5 seconds here, and let's take a quick break so we can hear that all in one thought from you. We are chatting with Michael Walsh here, the author of Rules for Radical Conservatives. We'll be back with you here at We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. And now you're listening to KCNR, 1460 AM. Except for the fact that Carolina's too far south, I guess you picked heads, huh?
I like Carolina, actually. I was born in North Carolina, so. But, you know, California is the best state in the country, let's face it.
Yeah, I lived in Connecticut years ago. That's where I grew up, and I always liked the Northeast. Their politics lately have gotten a little sideways, but I guess it's not a whole lot different than here, but the weather is much better.
Boy, the weather, when I left Connecticut a couple weeks ago, it was 10 below zero, so I thought, enough of this, it's time to get back to California.
Yeah, we would have been out shoveling. My daughter lives in Maine, so she's experiencing the balmy winter.
Yeah, New England is a wonderful place. It's very beautiful, as you know, Aaron, but it's been completely taken over by the lefties.
Yeah.
And the left sort of uses these big cities as incubating hatcheries, and then they send all these people out. When we moved to Connecticut way back, it was kind of a middle-of-the-road Republican state. Now it's become a very hard left state. And it's even brokered in California per capita, which is an amazing accomplishment.
That's kind of hard to pull off.
It is. It is. On a state that could fit into San Bernardino County easily with plenty of room left over, to have it so broke for no reason. It's just stunning. But then, as I say, the left never has a reason for what it does other than sheer animosity. And I think it's something that, you know, especially you guys up there in the part of California that most Californians have never even set foot in.
True.
As you know, that's the good part of California. That's the old-fashioned part of California. But you got to be aware that the left really is out to break us, and we have to like that. So that's one of the reasons I wrote Rules for Radical Conservatives, to show the threat as explicitly as possible, and have people try to wake up. So the book had a great deal of resonance, and you know, people write to me all the time and say, "Oh my God, I love this rule, that rule, and how can we fight that even harder?" And the first way you do that is to be
be aware of the nature of your opposition, and that's where the right falls down constantly, time and time again. I mean, just look at Speaker Boehner, for example, who has no idea what he's up against. And that's why he's so frustrating to Tea Party people, for example.
Uh-oh, we're losing you.
No, I'm still here.
Oh, there we go. I was going to say progressively farther away, but that's kind of ironic. let's say gradually. We don't want to use those ugly words this early in the day.
I'm up in the middle of the hills, and you never know what the cell service up here.
So. There you go. Well, okay, so talk about some of the rules. You know, let's just assume that most of the people listening have not read the book yet. So give them, like, a little primer on the book.
Well, I have to be from memory because I don't have it in front of me. And it's funny, people ask authors about their books all the time, and it's your relationship to your own book is a very strange one because you write it and you sort of channel your ideas, and it's not as if... Then people come to you years later and say, oh, I love the part on page 84, and you go,
ooh,
what?
Yeah, that would be really hard.
And especially in fiction, where you almost completely write in a kind of trance, and then when you have to answer questions from your fans, you realize they know the book better than you do. But in this case, I think a few of the rules are really important, and one of them is get better leaders. we have very poor leadership on the conservative side. On the Republican side, we have terrible leadership, and on the Tea Party side, we have no leadership. Effectively, although Cruz and Rand Paul have sort of headed for that goal and have staked their positions out to the right of the establishment Rhino Republican. I think this is so important, and I have a number of friends who are military officers who are about to retire, so they're majors and lieutenant colonels and colonels, and I've encouraged them to run for office because they have the moral authority that the left always prizes so much. They've been through it. And they also, I don't know very many military officers who are liberals, so they have a very realistic view of the world and the world's threats. And I would love to see the Tea Party hook up with the retiring military officers to get some of those guys and women involved in the political system. Because I know they care, but in their current jobs, they can't really do anything about it.
That's true. That's a good
idea. Once they're retired, they're good.
Yeah, that's not a bad plan. I mean, you know, you look at what's going on with our military, and you would think that they would have a vested interest in the political future of the country.
Well, you would, but remember, I mean, I grew up in the Marine Corps, so I'm a little aware of this, that military officers swear allegiance to the nation and to the commander-in-chief. So for them to actively oppose the commander-in-chief while on duty would be a violation of their oath. So they don't. So they try to repress the political activity. I remember once being very surprised when my mother told me, I asked her years later, who she and my father had voted for in the various elections, say Kennedy-Nixon of 1960 or the 64 election of Goldwater and LBJ. And she said they never voted. And I was surprised. And she said, well, Marine officers don't vote. I don't know whether that's true today or not, but it was true back in the 50s, 60s, and perhaps a little bit later, that in order to stay neutral politically, they took no interest in the electoral process. I suspect that's changing now, but I don't know for sure. Maybe one of our callers can tell us.
Well, it certainly is going to, it's certainly impacting them. You know, I mean, you look at some of these things that are happening politically. I just was reading an article. I work a lot for veterans benefits. I deal with that a lot through work. And it was a big article yesterday. I don't even remember what publication, but it was talking about the lag, you know, the lag in completing claims and all that, and I think everybody knows that that's a huge issue, but apparently they actually did run the numbers, and it's gotten much, much worse under Obama. And so it seems like it's always been bad, but I guess from the inside, looking at the numbers, it's gotten a lot worse in the last few years. So
now, these were claims for what kind of just veterans benefits?
Correct. So it's, you know, you, you're injured in the service at some point in time by something or from something, and when you get out, then trying to get help for that, you have to go through. It's what we'll all be facing with Obamacare, actually. It's just the precursor. You have to apply for a disability rating, and that determines your service. But, I mean, you have claims that are anywhere from several years to 35 years old. They just keep being denied because it's going to cost the government money. So they hold all the cards, so they just deny you. Nope, you're fine.
Yeah, that's a shame. Well, you know, what you guys, I was thinking when you were talking, Aaron, that you're really describing this vast bureaucracy. And I think what a lot of people have finally come to the conclusion is that, well, I spent a great deal of time in the old Soviet Union in the 1980s and right up to the time it collapsed. I was actually in Berlin when the wall came down, and I was also in Russia when Chernobyl blew up. So I've had quite an interesting first-hand view of that system. And it's effectively what we're turning into. Now, that doesn't mean, as a leftist would immediately leap to the conclusion that I'm talking about mass murder on an industrial scale such as Stalin did, and that's not at all what I mean. But when you tie yourself down with a federal bureaucracy, you will eventually have a sclerotic state that can't function anymore. And what we learned, for example, in dealing with the Soviets on a day-to-day basis was that bribery and corruption become the order of the day. That is, whenever we needed anything in Russia, we could either bribe somebody to get it, find a corrupt official who would deal with it, find an ordinary citizen who could be persuaded for a little bit of money to do whatever it was that we needed to get done, to go around the system. The system becomes an obstacle to everybody's functioning. Mm-hmm. So they learn to work their way around it. And that's why I'm getting a laugh out of the Sochi Olympics, because all of this next generation of journalists is going there and finding out how god-awful things are in Russia. Okay. Well, that's the result of this system, basically.
Oh, yeah, and for anybody who is just watching what's happening on television, I know I'm kind of always promoting Twitter, but it's a great way to get a really broad look at things in short snippets. You know, you don't have to get deluged with it. But if you just go to Twitter, even if you don't have an account, you should be able to see it. Put in @SochiProblems, all one thing. And you get all these pictures that fall out. I mean, they have toilet seats that are put on upside down. There's one picture with two toilets. Seriously, you would be elbow to elbow with the person in the other toilet. No wall between. You have toilets with a row of chairs in front of them. So I guess, obviously, that's the next guy in line. Apparently, privacy is not a big deal there.
I was thinking that was the toilet that LBJ should have used, because, as you know, he liked to give interviews while he was sitting on the john, and this way he wouldn't have even had to have a stall door. He could have talked directly to the journalist.
He could have the journalist sitting next to him.
Yeah. No, people laugh about this, but it's so, as we used to say in Russia, it's so Soviet, which meant whenever we encountered anything that was absolutely absurd, non-functional, or just plain idiotic, somebody would say, gosh, that is so Soviet. And Sochi is, you know, out in the middle of nowhere, Russia-wise, and it's not surprising that it is effectively a holdover from the Soviet era. And everyone's getting a good look, and I think we laugh at it because those Twitter pictures are hilarious, especially the one of the toilet with a wall running right down the middle of the toilet.
Oh my gosh, yeah, that's right, the half a toilet.
Yeah, the half a toilet. But it's how they think, and it's the result of central planning bureaucracy that has no relation to how human beings actually live. And what I would like the left to address is this notion that they are effectively anti-human in the guise of being humane. The practical results of all their policies are Russian toilets with walls running through the middle of them.
Yeah.
And they need to face that, and we have to make them face it, because they will assert paradise even while they live in hell. Which actually brings me to the subject of my new book, which is called The Devil's Pleasure Palace.
Nice.
And it will be about the first of all, the war between God and Satan based on Paradise Lost, which is one of my favorite poem books of all time. also the effect that the Frankfurt School and the whole culture of critical thinking or critical theory has had on American culture. I mean, if you look at it, it's the infection of an alien virus on a healthy body, which was the American spirit of optimism and can-do and frontier. And, you know, you might live under a bridge, but you could wind up a millionaire. And we got this importation of a German-European system, which is you might become a millionaire, but you could end up under a bridge. That's really the difference between how Europeans and Americans think. And the Frankfurt School and the Alinsky School, and they're both represented in the person of the current president, Obama, has been nothing but damaging to the American psyche. And everyone listening should understand this. That's what they're trying to do. They are trying to change. That's what fundamental change means. The entire notion of America. So, but it might be called America after they're done, but it will bear no resemblance whatsoever to the America that we thought we did have. And that's what people need to be very, very aware of.
I think that's an excellent point. And on that note, I guess we have to take another break. And Bill just got back with his computer cord. We're going to be all fully functional here. I'm sorry, I wasn't supposed to tell anybody how well. All right, be right back with you. We're talking to Michael Walsh, Rules for Radical Conservatives.
Been abused. Somebody blew up a building. Somebody stole a car. Somebody got away. Somebody didn't get too far. Yeah, they didn't get too far.
Grandpappy told my pappy back in my day, son, a man had to answer for the wicked that he done. Take all the rope in Texas, find a tall old tree, round up all of them bad boys, hang them high in the street for all the people to see.
That justice is the one thing you should always find. You gotta saddle up your boys, you gotta draw a hard line.
When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune, and we'll all meet back at the local saloon.
We'll raise up our glasses against evil forces, singing whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
Poets, priests, and politicians have words to say for their positions.
One question, comment, Michael, is speaking of the Sochi Olympics, the opening ceremonies, I was finding myself getting irritated at the glamour and the color and even the announcers glorifying the Russian history. And I know it's difficult for them to say anything negative about it, but Stalin wasn't really a really great guy, and I just hope they kind of tone that down a little bit during the Olympics, because it kind of angers me a little bit that they don't, or they want to actually, you know, look at Russia as this great society, and you know, we're heading in that direction if we don't we don't wake up.
Well, Russia is an interesting country. I mean, the communists were very surprised that Russia was the country that communism took root in, rather than Germany. Because the Germans are the ones who thought this up, let's face it. Marx was a German. Most of the principal theoreticians happened in Germany, because Germany was an industrialized, civilized country, and it would be the one naturally inclined to such workers' paradise revolution. And then it actually happened in the least developed, most backward third world nation that Europe has, short of the Balkans, which is the Russia. So the Russians are not terribly competent at much in terms of organization, except, of course, killing people. They're very good at that, and they're very good at warfare because they fight so ruthlessly until the end. But as far as social things, they're fairly inept. So that, again, what we're seeing in Sochi is an expression of latent Soviet pride. With Putin, remember, is a former KGB colonel. I first encountered Putin in Dresden in 1985 when I was traveling through eastern Germany into the late great German Democratic Republic.
Did he have his shirt on?
Well, it was very cold. It was actually 40 below zero.
That's child's play for Putin.
and the interesting thing about 40 below zero is that it's 40 below zero in Celsius and Fahrenheit. It's the place where the two temperature systems actually meet.
Huh.
Very cold. And an acquaintance of mine, who I shall remain nameless, warned me that the new KGB resident in Dresden, which was the most backward city of East Germany because it could not get West German television signal, and therefore was completely confined to Russian and East German propaganda. The new KGB resident was a very tough little monkey named Vladimir Putin, and so that was the first time I heard the name of Vladimir Putin, and now everyone's heard the name of Vladimir Putin. But he's an old Soviet, and Sochi just feels very Soviet. And I don't have a television, and I never watch television, so I haven't watched anything of the Olympics, nor will I. But I can certainly understand your distress at seeing what NBC, which is the farthest left television network we have, would naturally celebrate this. I just
think it's kind of funny that Bob Costas, who's narrating the whole thing, has pink eye.
Yeah, I heard about that. I saw that on the net.
I just thought that was ironic.
I think Putin stuck his finger in it. I don't know.
Apparently it was someplace bad before. It was in half a toilet. All right, we'll be right back. We're talking to Michael Walsh. We've got to take a break for news. You're listening to KCNR 1460 AM. Next hour, we will have our break spread out a little bit more. Sorry for our listeners. Stick with us. We have Michael in the next hour, too.
It's KCNR, Shasta Redding.
You're listening to We the People Radio. Oh, Elizabeth's not here, so she can't do that handy-dandy intro. Hit it, Bill.
We're streaming and chatting live at wethepeopleradio.us. You can join the conversation there or call us at 605-4567.
Sunday morning's kind of a quiet time. Mostly people are listening, drinking coffee. They might be hanging out in their sleep number beds on lounge setting. My new favorite idea. So we're talking to Michael Walsh here. He's the author of Rules for Radical Conservatives and a new book coming out. And I'm sorry, Michael, I didn't write it down. It was a great title, too. Give it to us again.
The Devil's Pleasure Palace. It'll be out next year.
The Devil's Pleasure Palace. And give us a sneak preview.
As I said, it's basically an examination of critical theory and its effect on American culture, especially seen through the frame of the God and Satan dialogues in Paradise Lost. It's more of an analytical and philosophical book. It's not so much a popularly directed book. I mean, unlike my thrillers, which obviously are for a mass market audience. So
sure.
That's something we should talk about, because they're all about the National Security Agency, so nothing of the Snowden revelations has come to a surprise to my lots and lots of readers. For the Devlin trilogy, that they know all about what the NSA does.
Yeah, for those people who made fun of us for all those years that that we knew that they were spying on us, and now it's like, aha!
Yeah. Well, remember, spying is, I've written three books in the Devlin series, and have a couple of new movie projects in the work that are also spy thrillers. So it's something I've spent a lot of time studying, and the NSA is tasked with essentially hoovering up every bit of information it can get its hands on, and the question is who watches the watchers and who and what use that information put to. So it's something that we have to think about as a representative democracy, which we want to maintain that status rather than as a quasi-administrative dictatorship, which is where democracy tends to head as the government bureaucracy gets bigger and bigger. And that's really the biggest danger to the country right now. As I was listening to the news, and in a part of our earlier conversation, forms to fill out, lines to stand in, approvals to get. This is not America. This is the old Soviet Union. That's all you did in that country was fill out forms and stand in line. And if that's the future, if that's fundamental transformation, count me out.
Oh, yeah. You know, the entire, you know, the permit process, I mean, need we say more? Everything is about filling out paper, spending a whole bunch of money, and then getting a permit to do something that was common, that used to be common sense.
They used to do anyway. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And you're so, waiting for them to measure irrational things like, you know, CO2, you know, that. Anyway, don't get me started.
You know, speaking of the NSA, Michael, you know, I find it comical that people, in a lot of cases, are shocked that we're, you know, spying on other countries and being involved in other countries' governments. You know, we've been doing that since day one. The public just has not been privy to the facts. And I, you know, I've always believed that a certain amount of that has to go on, and we don't need to know about it. But in this day of modern communication, the internet, I mean, you can't sneeze before somebody on the East Coast hears it. But, you know, that's always going to happen. I think the NSA has kind of crossed over a little bit, more than a little bit. But, I mean, don't you feel that there has to be a certain amount of secrecy on, you know, when we start involving ourselves in other governments, other countries, just to keep the peace?
Yes, well, you're really right. The difference now is that the spying agencies are spying on us.
True.
I think this gets to a larger topic, which is a little controversial, but I think almost everything the Bush administration did in the wake of 9/11 was wrong.
Yep, we're with you.
It has had a terrible effect on the country. I mean, one thing that everyone has experienced is the TSA. And, you know, wives, daughters, we all have have heard about how they're molested, in effect, by some of the pat-downs they get.
Oh, yeah.
The 300-plus million Americans are considered essentially terror suspects every time we get on an airplane. When we know who the terror suspects are, but refuse for politically correct reasons to prevent them from flying.
Yeah, and that's really it right there.
How can that not make everybody angry? And why are we putting up with this? I mean, we know the TSA is an employer of last resort, but the people that it hires tend to be out of work, jobless, or incapable of holding any other job. And we put them in charge of us. It's ridiculous.
Well, we had an Israeli security guy who regularly consults with some of our agencies here on the air, I don't know, year and a half ago. And so we asked him, you know, what does this stuff do? Does it actually help us? And he's like, it doesn't do anything. It just looks like it does something. It doesn't actually do anything. You could actually take bombs on planes with all the security we have now easily. And I thought, oh, awesome.
Yeah, but it does do one thing, though, Aaron. It inconveniences the free citizens of a representative republic for no reason whatsoever, other than the government gets to show you who's the boss. That is all that this is about. And it's part of the softening up process against the citizenry.
Yeah.
You know, which also involves the Second Amendment issues and everything else, that when you become a shuffling zombie, which is what the Soviets were, then that's easier to control. I just read something online the other day about how the Americans are finding when they smile at the Russians don't smile back. Well, that's typical American dopiness anyway, because Europeans are not as overtly friendly as we are, and they think our friendliness is phony. That's how it reads to them. But the Russians come from a country where you don't make eye contact with people. Forget about smiling with them.
Right.
Why would you even look at them? Because to look at someone is to ask for trouble. And so the idea of the TSA and everything else, the forms and the lines and the DMV, all this credentialism is to keep your eyes on the ground and focused on your feet, and you will be much less trouble going forward. That's what this is all about.
It's also about informing on your neighbor, and that's also obviously come in too, which is another facet of that is, hey, you know, in order to keep the country safe, you've got to watch your neighbor and just give a good call to the government there and let them know if you see anybody doing anything bad.
Right, so then the SWAT team can show up to your neighbor's house based on absolutely no information other than you're mad at your neighbor and break down his door,
right,
threaten him with guns. I mean, This is East Germany. I mean, I'm sure a lot of our listeners have seen the movie The Lives of Others, that won the Oscar for Best Foreign Language Film a few years ago. And it was about, in fact, that very issue, which is that in East Germany, the DDR, Deutsche Demokratische Republik, where I spent a lot of time, one in every three people was an informant for the government. How about that? One in every three.
Okay, so it's either Bob, Bill, or me.
Yeah, there you go. So you guys got to figure out which one of you is.
Bob's really quiet over there, but Bill had to leave for a little while. Yeah. Did he really forget his computer
cord?
Dropped
off a package somewhere. you know, I think you hit it right on the head, Michael, when you said it's all about letting everybody know who's in charge. Because, you know, that is so on point. You look at the government shutdown, that's all that turned into was just who's in charge. When you start throwing up barricades, and I mean that was
right.
And nobody rose up. That should have been the final straw, but it didn't go anywhere.
Well, when you can get the population, as I say, shuffling and looking at their shoes, you've won the argument. But when they shut down a monument that wasn't closed off in the first place, they had to go out of their way to close off that veterans memorial in Washington.
Well, look at Mount Rushmore.
That tells you everything.
They took Mount Rushmore and put tarps up so you couldn't see the mountain. I mean, they should have stormed it.
If we had a functioning media, that would have been topic A for a very long time. If that were a Republican administration, they would have made a big issue out of it.
Well, that's another great topic right there, is how are we ever going to get this media back in line and actually reporting the truth and not the agenda?
Well, that's one of the Rules for Radical Conservatives, which I wrote under the name David Kahane for reasons we discussed earlier, that with the liberals' view of conservatives, but the liberal telling the conservatives how to fight back because he's tired of them losing all the time. One of the rules that I now recall is the culture is the message, so seize it. Conservatives don't do culture very well, which is too bad because that's where the argument takes place. We don't. Our kids tend to go into business and you know, return on investment and all this other stuff, and lefty kids go to Hollywood, where I work now, go into publishing, go into journalism, go into academia. And that is how the argument gets framed. So because we don't participate in the cultural life of the country, we shouldn't be surprised that we don't have any influence on it anymore.
Well, how do you feel about let's say ex-media newspaper, say people going into politics? What slant would you think that would have?
Oh, come on, let's just tell him. The guy that writes the editorial page, it's been slamming Republicans. He thinks Agenda 21's fake. He, you know, loves all this environmental crap. Just went to work as the district director for our assemblyman.
Yeah, how about that? I mean, just look on the national level where journalists have joined the Obama administration in droves.
Right.
because they feel that this is actually, let me put it this way, I've been in journalism as a professional since 1971, too. I started on the Rochester, New York, Democrat Chronicle as a reporter in February of 1972. And I spent many years in journalism in Rochester, and then I was at the San Francisco Examiner, and finally I was on the staff of Time Magazine for 16 years. I've watched journalism change, but it is true that the journalists of my generation, that is the 60s generation, many of them felt that journalism was like becoming a lawyer, in that it was a way to be done with the struggle. And that you insinuated yourself into the media in order to cast the stories in the way that were most favorable towards your ideological position. Now, nobody admitted that for many, many, many years. But now the gloves are off, the lid is off, and they're all out of the closet. And as a result, you get someone like David Axelrod, who I pillory constantly as the Jake Lingle of journalism. And I'll explain Jake Lingle in a minute. But Axelrod started as a reporter on the Chicago Tribune, basically, became the City Hall bureau chief of the Chicago Tribune, and then realized he could do better for himself and the cause by actually managing candidates. So he crossed the street and went into the political consulting business. Now, that would have been anathema in the old days. And once a journalist became a PR person, in effect, you were done as a journalist.
Well,
but now they just revolve right back into journalism again. So it's all one big happy family.
You know, I think they need to redefine the word journalist, because it's they're not journalists. They're
political commentators.
Exactly.
Yeah, they pick
a side, and that's the news.
Yeah, that's true. It is propaganda. We're kind of back to the Sochi Olympics again. You know, like when there was one part, I'm sure you saw it on Twitter, where they had these snowflakes, and the five snowflakes like were dangling from wires, I guess. And as they kind of came into view and, you know, got into line, they started to get bigger and bigger and bigger, and they were supposed to be the Olympic rings right at the beginning. And one of the snowflakes, like, refused to open. So they just had four rings and a blob. But the Soviets apparently saw five rings because they went back and photoshopped it before they put it on television. So
that's how they do things there. So it's not surprising.
Yeah, nobody there knew it even happened.
Yeah, well, that's what I mentioned earlier about Dresden, the city in southeastern East Germany, which had been destroyed by the bombing in 1945. And I happened to be there. That was why it was so cold. It was February 13th, 1985, and it was the 40th anniversary of the destruction of Dresden by the American and British firebombers, which was a terrible war crime, but it was how we fought World War II to the end and to absolute and unconditional surrender. The Dresdeners were made fun of by the Berliners, for example, because the Berliners could get West German TV. They could get smuggled West German magazines and newspapers. They were very sophisticated. They knew that their government was lying to them 24 hours a day. And the Dresdeners, who also have a very funny accent in German, to speak German, didn't. So they were regarded as kind of the hillbilly country cousin of East Germany. But when the Soviet Union was a very large landmass, not very well organized, because not even a road from one end of it to the other. Not one single road goes from Leningrad, St. Petersburg, to Vladivostok.
Wow. Kind of an oversight.
It's too big, and they're disorganized, and they don't have that many people. Remember, Russia just has fewer population than the United States. They're just not organized, and they're not capable of organization. Again, it goes back to that's so Soviet. You'd see apartment buildings being built in Moscow, and half of them would be up. And if they were doing the new half, the old half would be already falling down. You wouldn't get in an elevator if you didn't have to. You would never ride on an amusement park ride. Because even though they bought them from the Germans and the Austrians, they didn't maintain them. So people would get killed on them constantly. Balconies would fall off new apartment buildings and plunge to the ground. Yeah. And that was actually considered opportunistically good for people who wanted to upgrade their apartment, because that tenant was now deceased, and that they could move out of their living with their mother. Remember, the other thing about the Russians is they live with their mothers forever. Or P.J. O'Rourke once said, living under communism is like living with your parents forever. It was literally true in Russia because there were so few dwelling spaces that people lived in two rooms apart. The whole families, staying people lived in two rooms apart. It's a terrible, terrible system. And to have anybody advocate for it with a straight face, as some idiot did recently in the pages of Rolling Stone, is just crazy. And it tells you that America itself is kind of the country cousin of the world because we're isolated, we have two big oceans, and we are dosed with propaganda from the left now, which just is itching to reestablish its Marxist-Leninist view elsewhere to show that it can work.
And that is such a great point, because we have to look at, you know, the crazy things that we're doing over here and swearing that it's a great move. And you have to wonder, well, you don't wonder, you know exactly what the rest of the world is thinking when they see us taking these backwards steps. We've got to take a quick break, Michael. Let's stay on this vein. I think
because we're always hearing from people that, people in Russia are more free than people in the U.S. May they choke on it. Maybe that was kind of too mean. but I meant it. May they choke on it. I'll say it again. There you go. You have it. We'll be right back with Michael Walsh here at We the People Radio.
Well, you filled up my head with so many lies, twisted my heart till something snapped inside. I'd like to give it one more try, but my give a damn's the same. Say you got a real solution. You want money for people with minds that hate. All I can tell you is, brother, you have to wait.
Welcome back, everybody. We are speaking to Michael Walsh, author of Rules for Radical Conservatives. Michael, you were talking earlier about your travels throughout the world and travels into some of the Eastern Bloc countries. I know it's changed, has to have changed through the years, but what do people think about the American viewpoints and what's going on in our politics right now? What do they look at?
Well, it's been a while since I was spent. I lived in Germany for almost 10 years, and I was based in Munich right around the time of the end of the Cold War. So again, I've been working in Hollywood for the last 10 years, so I'm a little bit out of that particular loop at the moment. But I think people look at America, they look at America as what it used to be, and that's what they want to be part of. And then they come here and they find out it's what they just left, or it's becoming what they just left. Excuse me. So there's a kind of cognitive breakdown here when they thought they were coming to a land of freedom and opportunity, and they come to a land of paperwork and deficit spending and roads that are pathetic and long lines for everything.
Yeah, and I think
that, I think, is the worst thing about what's happening.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's still the greatest country on the planet, but, you know, you used to say, as bad as it is, it's always better than everywhere else, but how we're so close to changing.
Well, I don't think that's true anymore.
Sure it is either.
Yeah, I live part of the year in Ireland, and I much prefer there to here. In terms of this, in Ireland, which is where my family's from, and I live in my great-grandmother's birthplace, if you want to do something, there are rules. But everyone will tell you, it's Ireland, just do what you want. And it's got a great deal more personal freedom and autonomy than the U.S. does, where, you know, in some communities, like the one I live in Connecticut, you can't do anything to your house without getting permits and building permits. You can't fix the back porch without a permit. And why would you have to have a permit to live? I mean, that's essentially what the logic of this, where it goes in the end, is that you must have a permit to live. And that is not the founding of the United States. That's not what the Constitution is about. Not what the Declaration of Independence is about, because there it's, you know, well, life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness don't need permits, but they do now. So what are we going to do about it is the question. Right. I mean, I'm 64 years old. I don't care. I literally don't care anymore because I'm towards the end of my life rather than the beginning. But if I were 24 years old, I would care a great deal. And I think that the young people really need to wake up on that.
Well, you know, you're exactly right. I was told by a building inspector in the town that I won't mention right now that I work in, that pretty much you need a permit to do anything to your building short of changing a light bulb. You need a permit to do it, technically.
Right.
But then I found out after speaking to one of our more higher-up county officials that they can't even change a light bulb. They wait until they get enough of them burned out because it costs them a minimum of $200 to have the electrical union come in and change the light bulbs for them because that's against the rules.
Exactly.
And that is, I mean, where does this nonsense stop?
It does not stop until it collapses, which is what happened to the Soviet Union, or until a revolution that eliminates it. Those are the only two things that can happen. You cannot keep a population in slavery. That we've learned. And whether it's benign slavery, such as we have here, with filling out permits and getting permissions, and who said, that someone needs to stand up and say, on what authority do you claim this right over me? Because you do not have it, period.
Right.
And that's it.
That is it. And I think that's where people have to get. And, again, how bad does it have to get?
Well,
it'll get really bad. Don't kid yourself. It'll get as bad as it did in the Soviet Union. But, again, that was a place, when I first went there, the first time, 1986, when Chernobyl blew up, and you realize that nothing worked, and everyone was corrupt, and every woman was a whore, every man was for sale, and everything you wanted, you could buy, and if you had Western money, you could wake up in the morning, have a beer and a Havana cigar to start your day, and the rest of the people had nothing.
Yeah.
I said to myself, this cannot go on, because it is a society that has already lost a war. You know, after the war in Germany, the German girls, you could have a girlfriend for the price of a pair of nylon stockings. In Russia, you saw the same thing happening. You hitchhike by holding up a number of fingers, which indicated how many packs of Marlboros you were prepared to give the driver, or the taxi driver, who was also moonlighting as a capitalist, over the official system. One day, a guy picked me up. I needed a ride from somewhere to somewhere. And he pulled off the side of the road. He opened the trunk, and there was tons of caviar and vodka, which he wanted to sell me. I mean, everyone was a freelancing capitalist in this communist society. So I came back from that, and I said, what are we afraid of with these people? First of all, they're technologically inept. Half their missiles will stay in the silos. The other can blow up. The other half will go straight up and come straight down on their
It's an entirely
corrupt society that is incapable of defending itself except through the last latching out of self-preservation. There's a much better way to break the Soviet Union. And in fact, that's what Reagan did by playing poker against them when their game is chess. And they didn't understand that in poker you can just bluff your rear end off and still win the pot. That was alien to them, because in chess, when you cannot win, you resign. And that's what they did in 1991, is they resigned. Well, Americans don't play chess very well, but we do play poker. And essentially, this is all a giant bluff, that if people stood up and said, enough is enough, we're not going to take it anymore. We're mad as hell, and we're not going to take it anymore, like the line from Network. It would change. But until that happens, it won't change. And if you boil the frog incrementally, the frog doesn't hop up.
Absolutely.
That's where we are.
I was listening to another show here a couple of weeks ago, and they listed off during World War II the amount of goods and supplies that the Americans made during the war, as far as the battleships and aircraft carriers and tanks and jeeps and on and on and on and on. All this stuff that we manufactured and shipped for the war effort over a 4-year period, and it was just this huge list, and it was unbelievable. And yet, we've had 5 years or 4 years, whatever it is, and we can't build a website to handle healthcare.
No.
You know, and, right. And that is really sad that's where we are right now, is we can't get out of our own way to get anything done. And I'm flabbergasted that people haven't spoken up more than they have. And I think a lot of that goes back to people don't want to jeopardize what they're getting free from the government, and that list is getting longer and longer and longer.
Yes, if you create a nation of junkies, you will have a dependent population. So the latest absurdity was Obamacare freeing people from work. Now that is the ultimate expression of what they're after, which is to make everyone a dependent. Remember, liberalism is predicated on this one simple fact, which is a lie, but of course people don't realize it, that if you only make this change, nothing else will change. That is to say, let's just take an example, the Clean Water Act, or some environmental crazy, right? No one is against saving the snail darter or the delta smelt in Sacramento or whatever. But it never occurs to them to ask, what are we giving up in order to do this? Because the left will say, well, we're saving the smell. Well, they're not. You're, in effect, destroying the infrastructure of the country, because an army of leftist lawyers will now descend on you and tie you down like Gulliver in Lilliput until you cannot move. All for nothing, essentially, a little fish.
Mm-hmm.
Which, if it disappeared tomorrow, would make zero difference to the planet, zero. But that's how they work. They accomplish great things through little teeny-weeny means. And you have to stop them when they do it, or they'll keep on doing it. Because, as I like to say, they never stop, they never sleep, they never quit. We are their job 24 hours a day.
No, you're absolutely right. And I think that our first wake-up call on that was the great spotted owl debacle. Everybody laid down for that. You know, as soon as the Endangered Species Act was passed, the environmentalists jumped on that, and slowly but surely now they have tied us down like Gulliver.
But to stick with his analogy, it's interesting because the left played poker on that one, and we played chess.
Yeah, that's true. Good point. We fell for that bluff.
Yeah, we kept going for the facts. You know, we always go for the, hey, but that's not real, that's not true. It's kind of like, it doesn't matter.
No. Remember, they work on emotion. The facts are secondary. And again, look at California. I mean, I come back, I believe, to California off and on now 3, 4, 5 times in my life. Every time I come back, somebody named Brown is the governor. It's funny, because when I grew up here, Edmund Pat Brown was the governor, and then I left, and I came back to work in San Francisco, and Jerry Brown was the governor, and then I left and came back, and now Jerry Brown's the governor again, after having been a bum and an attorney general and a hobo and whatever else he's, you know, done in his life.
So we can blame you for this?
Yeah, exactly. The mayor of Oakland, suddenly I come back, and now he's the governor.
And wait a minute, you were at Chernobyl, and what were some of those other, hey, wait a second.
Yeah, no, it's actually quite an interesting, if you trail me, you see that the chaos and misery is falling.
Chaos and misery.
I feel a little bit like the bizarro world Forrest Gump. So anyway, someone
You're like a superhero, only you're like the bad kind.
Exactly. I mean, it's kind of terrible to realize that that's who you are. And here in California, it's worse than ever. Worse than ever. And broke. And has no money. And is tied down. I mean, Victor Davis Hanson, my colleague at National Review and at the PJ Media, is very eloquent on this, because he's a third or fourth generation farmer in the Central Valley.
Ooh,
and he sees what the policies have done, in addition to being a professor in the Cal State system and a fellow at the Hoover Institute.
I bet he loves that. I bet he has a lot of colleagues there that go along with his views.
Well, he lives it, because he has to drive into Stanford, and you know, coastal California, life is great. I mean, if you make money in pushing numbers around the screen,
you know, or some other thing that's not a real world job you have a great life and you live in inflated real estate values, and the laws that you pass against, say, firearms, you don't have any guns in your house because, after all, you have a sign out front that says armed response. Someone else with a gun will come and get the guy with the gun breaking into your house. Well, so not you, but for the rest of the world, we have to defend our families, we have to pick walnuts, we have to do stuff, and all of these things impact us, but they don't care. That's the key. They don't care. And as long as there's enough of them in West L.A. and in the Bay Area and in Silicon Valley to vote left, they will dominate your part of the state and the Central Valley and the desert and all of the things that make California such a unique and wonderful place. It's essentially an oligarchy of coastal do-nothings.
Yeah, it's sad. I mean, California at one time was, what, the fifth largest economy on the planet, and now look, we're in shambles.
Well, what happens to, tell me, because I've never been to Redding, actually, but tell me what happens, what's the North State point of view there? I've never been north of, you know, Mendocino. I mean, not California, but Oregon, Washington.
Oh, wow. Well, contrary to popular belief, we have all the trees.
You do? That's interesting.
We have trees. I was going to say we have trees to burn, and actually that's very true. They've let our forests completely overgrow, so we've got more trees than you could shake a stick at. I can't stop. I'm in a loop. No, we have a lot of trees. We have a lot of space. We have a lot of nice people. Actually, people are very friendly here. And you know, we do kind of march to our own drum. Interestingly enough, one of the headlines in our paper here the last day or so has been a guy who was building model rockets or something, but had enough explosive material to actually blow his hand off and evacuate the entire neighborhood. So it's we've yet to get to the bottom of exactly what all those explosives were for, but... You know, but we don't inform on our neighbors here, you know, kind of we leave people to their own.
The flip side is we're totally not represented up here either.
There's a huge issue there.
I mean, you got...
Well, that's what I was going to ask, because how do you feel about having all these laws passed by coastal elites that... Who, like me, have never even set foot in Northern California.
Well, we're so excited about it that an entire movement has it's never been gone, but it has been a real resurgence of late with the state of Jefferson. So the idea of splitting the state has very much come into play. And interestingly enough, the driving force behind that is the youth. They realize that there's no point in living in the California that we're in now if, in fact, they want to be free citizens.
Well, why would you want to live, say, in Redlands or northern, other even further north, and be ruled by somebody who lives in Malibu? I mean...
Yeah. We don't, and that is the problem. You know, we have one representative in Congress for what
11 counties,
and you know, Los Angeles alone has 26. I mean, that's
right.
What we're up against,
and at the statewide level, we're completely outgunned.
Well, we might as well not even show up in the
state. Yeah, it really is kind of kind of amazing. So people are really pressing the taxation without representation, not just as a slogan, but as a fact.
Well, the fact you have no right of self-determination in Northern California. You effectively don't exist except to be exploited.
Their movement is to basically get everybody in Northern California to move south and turn this all into a giant park where, you know, we'll have...
Where no one can come, actually.
Nobody can come, and we'll have wolves and grizzly bears, and, you know, it'll all be like it used to be. And that's what they envision, which is just totally ridiculous.
Well, it's interesting you say that, because, I mean, yes, the left loves to put nature in... They think of nature as a petting zoo, because as long as nature doesn't break through their back door, you know, they're fine, where you guys have to deal with, like, bears and stuff, right?
Well, interestingly enough, like, the Fish and Game Commission is trying to decide if they should relist the wolves that really have never been here, and spending a lot of time on that so they can do what they did to Idaho, Oregon, Montana, Wyoming, New Mexico, all those places. I mean, what the heck? why would we introduce a big predator like that? They wouldn't do that in Golden Gate Park. They wouldn't do it in, you know, L.A., but they'll do that to us up here. And, like, I mean, we had a speaker who was going to come and visit, and the guy lives in L.A. He had an engagement in Stockton, just south of Sacramento, and he was going to come to Redding Monday night and be in Stockton Tuesday night. And I said, you do realize you're going to drive through Stockton to come here, don't you? And he said, well, yeah, but you're just on the other side of Sacramento. I'm like, yeah, 2 hours and some change.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, we're way past. He's like, oh my gosh, I didn't realize there was that much of California.
Right.
And he lives in the state.
Well, they think of San Francisco as Northern California, and of course, it's sort of really middle California when you look at the map.
Oh, yeah.
I'm fascinated by this Jefferson thing because it seems so un-American to effectively disenfranchise a third of the state's geographic area to turn it into a petting zoo. And this is a leftist project. For example, Hitler, during World War II, had various ideas, and one of them was to take the city of Linz, Austria, where he'd been born very near to Linz. I think he was actually born on the Austrian side of the border, and turn it into sort of giant museum to National Socialists. Another idea he had was to take the Jewish ghetto in Prague, which Prague was not destroyed. It's such a beautiful city, even the Nazis couldn't wreck it. But his idea was to save a percentage of the Jewish population of Europe that he wasn't going to murder and put them in the ghetto as a kind of living human zoo.
Yeah,
to show,
right.
To show that the Aryan people, this, you know, the enemy in his view, they have this, leftists have this instinct to do that. I don't know what it is about them, but they love this sort of thing. And then it was going to recreate Berlin along the lines of ancient Rome. I mean, they're nuts, and they have these megalomaniacal views. But it would be just like them to turn Northern California into, you know, dead like it if it was Nevada, where the federal government owned 90% of it. And again, it gets back to the notion of compromising personal autonomy. That is what they are all. Everything they do is about constricting your freedom to be you.
And the sad,
that's how you fight them, by understanding that. Go ahead. Sorry,
no. Yeah, and we want to, let's close with that when we come back. We've got one more break to take. We're going to come back with Michael Walsh and catch his final thoughts. I need to let you know that if you like conservative radio, which is about our last bastion of freedom around these parts, you're listening to We the People Radio. Just after our show is Sovereign Minds, and that show, whoops, something bad just happened.
I think we lost him, but we'll get him back.
Ruh-roh. So, anyway, if you like conservative radio and you like these ideas and you would like to hear certain guests or more of them, please let us know. My phone number is 530-515-7135. Also, with that, you can catch up on our fundraiser. You don't want to miss it. If you like guns and you like to hang out with people who like conservative ideas and radio, we are having our second annual banquet and fundraiser. It's Saturday, March 8th. It'll be at Wind River Casino, 4:30 p.m., dinner at 6:30, so I guess we have 2 hours to do some fun stuff. I know we have silent auctions and all that good stuff.
Oh, last year's event was a blast.
It was awesome.
It was a great event. You don't want to miss it.
And so that keeps these 3 hours of programming on Sunday morning on the air for a full year, actually. Single tickets, $30. Couples are $50. Table sponsor is $400. And you get a ton of tickets for that $400. Linda will give you that in the next hour. But we do hope you'll join us. That's March 8th. You can give me a call for that. You can also pick up tickets at Jones Fort here in Redding on Cypress Avenue. You can catch them from North State Consultants. Their phone number is 221-0101, or again, for me. So, there you go. We'll be right back with you. Take a quick break and finish out with Michael Walsh. You're listening to KCNR 1460 AM.
Time is really wasted. There's no guarantee.
California and South Alabama and little towns all around.
Welcome back, everybody. We're speaking to Michael Walsh, author of Rules for Radical Conservatives. And we have one more segment here, Michael. I'd like, if you could, give us a few more examples or
people want those rules.
We want those rules.
We promised them rules. They want the rules.
Okay, now, I'll give you the rules.
All right, I've got them all.
I got them right in front of me. Rule number one is know your enemy. Know his intentions and his weapons and use them against him. The only way to fight the left is the way they fight you, which means you've got to fight ruthlessly, you've got to fight dirty, you've got to infiltrate them, you've got to destabilize them, and you've got to wreck them. Think of it as a counterintelligence operation against the left. That's the way you do it. Rule number two is become what you behold. This is partly a riff on rule number one, how to talk like a liberal, how to understand what they mean when they say things. What does tolerance mean? What does compassion mean? Everything they do is to break your spirit, so understand that. Rule number three, the culture is the message, so seize it. Get your kids involved in it. Let them be writers. Let them be screenwriters. I mean, as a conservative screenwriter in Hollywood, I put no politics whatsoever in my scripts. None, zero. That's the way you actually get a conservative movie made. Stop thinking ideologically and just get in the game. Rule number four, get on offense and stay on offense and take no prisoners. Again, goes back to fighting the left the way they fight you. They're always on offense. We tend to think, hey, Reagan won 49 states, so we've won the argument. No, no, they don't sleep, they don't quit. Rule number five, let the dismantling begin. Mm-hmm. I believe that the Republicans in Congress are serious when the wrecking ball shows up and destroys the Commerce Department. Until that happens, they are not serious about reducing the size of government. Rule number six, at all times, think constitutionally. We talked about this morning, the left, I knew this day would come, and now it is here. They literally now criticize openly the Constitution of the United States. They don't like it. They've never liked it. They want to get rid of it. We need to defend it, or else we're out of business. Rule number seven, adopt the time-honored conservative message for a new kind of America and a new kind of American. This goes against a lot of the Yahooism on the right about immigration. Legal immigration is great. My great-grandmother got on a boat when she was 16 years old in Ireland and came over to the United States and learned the English language and made something of herself. Our new immigrants want to do that, too, and make them Republicans. Don't let them fall into the dependency trap of voting for the Democrats. Rule number eight, get better officers. We talked about that before. Our leadership is terrible. They're country club Republicans, Rotary Club Republicans, Midwestern nice guy Republicans. They are not cut out for the fight against the urban left. Rule number nine, never stop fighting till the fight is over. The line that I borrowed from David Mamet's great screenplay for The Untouchables, never stop fighting till the fight is done. It was Elliot Ness against Al Capone. We are the Elliot Ness character. Never stop fighting till the fight is over. Rule number 10, the fight is never over. We're in this forever, people. There is no ending. It is part of the eternal struggle between God and Satan, between good and evil, between capitalism and communism, however you want to define the terms, and you have to choose which side you're on. Those are the rules. That's how you do it.
Well, that's a great list. I listened to you during that, and it was like, boy, what do we got to do to get our leadership in Washington to listen to that and to stop mamby-pambying around with trying to fight these guys with all the PC rules they go by? It is time to fight. It is time to call it like you see it and get rid of some of this
stuff.
I think
people like the truth, too. You know, everybody's afraid they're going to offend somebody, and that, I think, it's a myth. I think people like the truth.
I think you're right, Aaron. In Hollywood, we have a saying that in a movie, there should be a cheer moment, it's called. And a good example of a cheer moment is in the first Rocky, where Rocky finally gets a shot at Apollo Creed, and the fight starts, and Apollo Creed is just wailing the tar out of him. And all of a sudden, out of left field, Rocky's famous left hook floors Apollo Creed, knocks him right off his feet. And the audience goes nuts, because it's finally the worm turns, and the little guy fights back, and he gets his
you know, he makes his point. People want the cheer moment. And until John Boehner stands up and says something really nasty to Nancy Pelosi, we're not going to get that cheer moment. And let me tell you, you're not going to get it from John Boehner. You're not going to get it from Eric Cantor. If the Tea Party can't take over the Republican Party, we're not going to win this fight. The current Rhino Republican establishment must be defeated. So I have really become quite a radical on this subject, that Boehner should be primaried, Sanders should be, every one of these guys should be primaried to within an inch of his life and made to feel the pain of taking the base of their party for granted, which is what they do, and then they sell you out constantly. Why put up with this?
Exactly. Boy, next time you come to California, next time you come to California, we need you to come out and speak to our Tea Party. I mean, we could pack the house with talk like that.
We've got several hundred people every Monday, so yeah, it's not like we're hurting for, you know.
No, I'll be back, I hope, in April or May, and it would be great to set that up. Then I'll get to see Northern California.
I was going to say, you'll actually get to see real California. We consider the rest kind of fake California.
I've heard about it, and I've never really believed it existed, so this is very exciting.
And it's insanely beautiful.
Yeah, I bet it is.
Yeah, we would absolutely love to have you. That'd be fantastic.
That'd be super fun.
Well, thank you for spending 2 hours of your Sunday morning with us, Michael. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I mean, it took, after Mass, my mind is usually elsewhere, but it took me a few minutes to get into the conversation, but I've really enjoyed it.
No sweat. We have to go to church now, too, so we can, purge all the mean thoughts we have all the time.
Exactly. Now we all have to atone.
I know.
I've done that. You guys go ahead and you take care of
yourself. We'll have to go apologize.
Thank you, Michael.
Thanks a million.
Welcome. Okay. Talk to you soon.
Thanks. Coming up next, Sovereign Minds with Mike. Mark. He could go by Mike, I don't know, whatever, whoever he wants to be, and Linda. They're going to tell you all about all the good stuff we have coming up. See you at the Tea Party tomorrow night if you are here in Reading. And that's it from here.
All right, have fun at confession. This is KCNR.